Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Emily Owen, author of the debut novel, The Mechanical Maestro, the first volume of the Abernathy series. Emily, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, if someone hasn't heard about your novel, The Mechanical Maestro, yet, how would you describe the novel?
I suppose it's like a historical fiction novel, but it's got like a hint of like the steampunk genre about it. So it's based around a family of three siblings who are all geniuses. The two brothers invent, I suppose, what we call AI, so like clockwork androids, and the sister, her expertise is kind of like transformative plant biology. And the series kind of focuses on sort of their adventures and sort of focuses on the androids they create. And in the first one, it's sort of seeing them going from just sort of getting by in this knackered old clock-making shop and then sort of getting a bit of a lucky break, really, and then what happens after that and what these inventions that are quite anachronistic in that context, how they affect Victorian society.
And so do you remember the original idea or impetus that led you to writing The Mechanical Maestro?
Well, I suppose I've had an interest in kind of like the steampunk kind of subculture for quite a few years. And I've always thought kind of like the things like H.G. Wells and Jules Verne. But I've always had an interest in kind of like, well, I suppose what we'd say robots rather than sort of automata. So I guess it was a combination of those two things. And I remember it was back in 2014, I was just about to start studying English at the University of Leeds. So I had, because I've always wanted to be an author, that's always sort of been a dream job. So I just kind of, whilst listening to music actually, because one of the book's quite sort of immersed in music as well, that's another key theme, that I kind of came up with these characters and sort of built the story around them. And I just thought, well, I've got this time now when I don't have any exams anymore or anything, so I'm going to actually try and sit down and finish a novel from start to finish. And that's what I did. And then I thought, well, if I've enjoyed writing this, maybe somebody will enjoy reading it. So I gave it to one of my colleagues and who sort of likes the same sort of genre, that kind of sort of not too serious, kind of fantasy things like Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett and those sorts of authors. And she gave it some quite positive feedback. So it kind of went from there, really. And whilst I was studying at uni, I did my undergraduate dissertation about representations of androids in 18th and 19th century literature. So that kind of helped flesh out the story and the ideas within it as well.
So you said that you sat down and wrote a novel from start to finish. Had you written or tried to write novels before then?
I tried to, but I think a lot of people will find this, that when you're first starting out, you tend to sort of run out of steam halfway through. So I tried to write novels in my teens, but I'd probably get a couple of chapters in and it would kind of fizzle out. But it was around when I was 17 that I really started to learn more about what steampunk was and read more Victorian literature and discovered, well, those kind of like a whole genre of music associated with that. And I think it's that kind of was the driving force behind it. And I thought, well, this idea is kind of different to what I've done before. Because before that, I'd been writing things that were kind of like more sort of modern, kind of real life about kind of like teen dramas, that kind of thing. So I suppose it was just something a bit different and it was just really fun to write.
Sure. Well, you had mentioned that you came up with these characters while you were listening to music. Did you write while listening to music as well?
Yeah, I actually have a playlist for all four books in this series. So sometimes it can be that an idea, like a particular scene or character, actually is inspired directly by a song, or I'll just be trying to write something and then I'll just sort of, as I'm on YouTube or something, I'll hear a particular song or piece of music and think, oh, this kind of really fits the mood for this, and that kind of sort of inspires you to write when maybe on a day when you're not particularly feeling sort of in the right zone for it.
And what kind of music do you listen to, or what kind of music inspires you?
I suppose it's a bit of an eclectic mix because I come from quite sort of a musical household. Like both my dad and my brother play music, and we've got dozens of guitars and drum kit piano, all sorts of things in this house, and I'm learning to play the violin as well. So I sort of grew up listening to the sort of music my dad likes, like sort of classic rock, lots of Beatles, ELO, Pink Floyd, Jethro Tull, Beach Boys, that sort of thing. I quite like classical music as well. And there's also artists that could be considered in the steampunk genre, things like Abney Park and Steam Powered Giraffe and the Clockwork Quartet and Alice's Night Circus. So it's a bit of a mix. It just kind of depends, like, whether it's quite a dramatic part of the story or something that's a bit more funny, or if it's something that's kind of more focused on, like, the inventions aspect of it.
So what attracts you to the steampunk genre and setting?
I'm not too sure, really. I mean, it's something I've always liked, even before I really knew what it was. So I can remember seeing the Disney film Atlantis when I was young, because that's got a similar kind of look to it. And I'm watching the film Howl's Moving Castle and things like that, and just thinking, oh, wow, this is really cool. And I remember going to see the War of the Worlds stage show in my teens. I think I read the book first and thinking it was absolutely amazing. And it was my friend who sort of got me more into it. And yeah, it's just something that I've always liked, really. I think it's just the look of, like, the fashions and, like, the metallic element, like all the clockwork and everything like that.
So when you sat down to write The Mechanical Maestro, did you plot the novel extensively before you began writing, or did you just jump into the story to see where it goes?
I suppose I just jumped in, really. Sometimes when I write, it starts as like a number of loosely connected scenes. And usually what I do is, like, I'll know where I finish and I'll know where my starting point is. And it's like, right, how do we get from A to B? Nowadays, having since finished the novel, I'm a bit more disciplined about the structure and I've got better at plotting. But I think that was kind of what was fun about this one, being it the first novel. Like, it was just kind of a journey of exploration. It was just a chance to sort of do what I want, really, because I wasn't really thinking at the time about getting it published or anything. The goal was just to finish it. So it was just getting a bunch of different ideas together and seeing where it went, and just sort of building the story around sort of my trio of siblings.
Sure. Well, now that you have your first novel published, what writing advice would you offer for those who are working on their own stories or novels?
I think a piece of advice that I heard once that's stuck with me since is to write with your heart and edit with your head. So not to worry too much about if an idea is going to work or not. If it's interesting to you and you're enjoying writing it, then the chances are somebody's going to enjoy reading it. So sort of just have a bit of a play and see what works and what doesn't. I think my creative writing tutor once said that your first draft is your discovery draft, where you're just testing out ideas, and it's only once you've sort of let it settle for a bit and come back to it that you think, right, this needs pulling out, this needs more explanation, this needs tidying up. And I think I'm a bit more disciplined now, but I don't worry too much about what people think of the story at first.
Well, what novels or nonfiction books have you read recently that you enjoyed and that you would recommend?
At the minute, I think last year I undertook a reading project because during lockdown I didn't have too many books about, and I just found this, like, a pretty book sort of lying around. I think it was The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and absolutely loved it. And then I said, right, since it's like the 100th anniversary of the first Poirot book, I'm going to read all 40-odd Poirot books in the space of a year. And I just managed it just in December. But I did learn a lot from reading Christie about how to plot twists and turns, because she is like the queen of crime writing and that sort of thing. I think recently, the last book I read, I think it's called The Shape of Darkness. I can't remember. I think the author's name is something like Lucy Thistle. And that's kind of historical fiction, but it's more sort of gothic and dark and supernatural than the sort of things I write. But it was quite a gripping story.
And what do you think you learned from that year of reading Agatha Christie?
I think what she does well, I think, is how she balances kind of light and dark elements in the story, in the sense of she'll have these grisly, horrible murders, but then there's all these little moments of humour and sort of warmth between some of the characters, and how she can just sort of have a dig almost at some of the very Englishness of some of the characters and the places where Poirot ends up. And just the way she just springs things on you at the end, but then when you look back and you can see how everything joins up together to come to that solution. So it's something I'm trying to, well, not emulate, but to bear in mind.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Maybe I'm trying to spring a surprise on the reader.
So do you think that you will try to take some of those lessons into your writing as you go forward?
I think so, yeah, because I'm on the third draft of the next book in the series at the minute. And I've been trying to think of some of the lessons I've learned from that reading project.
Well, where can people find you online if they want to learn more about you and your novel, The Mechanical Maestro?
I do have an author's website. It's www.e-owen.uk. And the book also has a Facebook page. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Emily Owen, author of the debut novel, The Mechanical Maestro, the first volume of the Abernathy series. The book is on sale now, so go buy a copy. And Emily, thanks for doing this interview.
No problem.
Great. Now stay tuned as Emily Owen reads from her novel, The Mechanical Maestro.
For almost 3 weeks, Douglas kept the automaton hidden away in his bedroom and refused to let George see it. Instead, he had to gauge from Douglas's smirking at him every time he passed it, that he was on the right track. More often than not, however, George would lose patience and demand to know exactly what his brother was up to. "You'll see soon enough," was all he ever got in reply. "But how soon? That rich fool will be here in less than a fortnight." "And when he does," replied Douglas coolly, "he will have to concede defeat to us." This was payback on Douglas's part, of course, for George's arrogance, and for having been kept in the dark for so many months. He took a somewhat wicked delight in watching his brother wringing his hands and pacing the length of the house. Perhaps it would teach him mental humility, to not put too much faith in his own genius, and accept the help and advice of others when he needed it. Then again, he knew George too well to hope for that. At least George had shaved and rediscovered soap and water. Not to mention he was keeping the business ticking along while Douglas worked on the automaton. On the night before Lord Dyson was due to arrive, Douglas told George to fetch a candle and follow him upstairs. The candle's feeble flame only devoured a small patch of darkness inside Douglas's room, but George could make out great stacks of books, some towering, ceiling. He also caught a glimpse of Douglas's small pianoforte, which Douglas must have taken back out of the pawn shop. George felt his shoe stump against something and picked it up. Looking over the title of the battle book in his hand, a book of nonsense by Edward Lear, he threw it back into the darkness, which readily swallowed it whole. There. Douglas raised the candle so the light shone on a figure seated in a chair at the far end, facing towards the window with its back to them. The candle's flame was flickering precariously, so the figure flitted in and out of sight. But George could make out chips of brown hair, probably a wig, with the ends curled into tight rolls. It was only when George took possession of the candle and got closer that he realised the wig was made of wood. Walking around the seated gentleman, George saw that it was a billy, polished maple skin. It was dressed in an old-fashioned style, wearing a blue velvet coat, green waistcoat, and grey breeches. Its feet wore wooden flocks. Only the blood of yellow eyes testified that it was, in fact, his android. "I like your choice for the casing. Make will have a violin," said George eventually. "I confess I may have used a little artistic license, but I doubt simply dressing it up like this will serve much purpose. The man might be a foppish fool, but it's unlikely this will convince him of anything. I haven't only made cosmetic changes. Watch." Douglas took the key from his pocket and unbuttoned the square flap of concealer on the front of the attendant's shirt that concealed the panel. After he had wound it, a ticking came from inside, and the automaton stood upright. It started a little, beholding George standing there. Douglas presented it with the violin once more. The automaton took its time composing itself. Finally, a tender, plaintive note was drawn from the violin, quickly followed by another and then another, the mood of the melody gradually lifting. It was as if each note were a single bubble that rose and burst in the air with a shower of golden sparks. The violin was possessed with an ethereal voice that spoke to the very soul and seemed to come from somewhere beyond the material world, in a language that was beyond words and was not quite music. Suddenly the soul moved much more rapid in pace, the bow feathered across the strings with the utmost delicacy, and the automaton's fingers flickered across the strings in a blur, hardly touching them. No human could ever have played with such speed or vivacity. It was unlike anything Douglas and George had ever heard before. The effect it produced on them was indescribable. George had the most peculiar sensation, as if something had ripped hold of his heart which floated away erratically, while the rest of his body seemed to have dissolved away, leaving him floating adrift. As the song was nearing a climax, it came crashing down again and melted into a slow adagio. The automaton let the last note fade away, lowered the violin, and bowed. It was only as it rose that it noticed the bow was a shredded mess of horsehair. "Well, George?" Douglas's voice quavered with slackened emotion. "I'd say it works, wouldn't you?" George failed to reply, continuing to stare wide-eyed at the automaton. Even when Douglas snapped his fingers before his eyes and poked him in the arm, he made no response. He remained in this state for a minute or two, and then all of a sudden his hand shot out and grabbed Douglas by the front of his shirt. "What did you do? What was it I missed?" "Nothing. All I did was simply providing with inspiration." "Inspiration?" exclaimed George in disbelief as he released his hold. "Yes, you tried working about it." Douglas smoothed down his shirt. "You said it yourself that creativity is simply about making connections between things, but this automaton of yours had no reservoir of knowledge that it could make connections from. What I did was open up the world to him. I showed him books and pictures not only about music, but also about history, nature, and literature. I even managed to smuggle him into a music hall to see a performance there." "You mean to say that while I was at my wit's end, you were reading to it and taking it to concerts?" "Correct." "Putting matter aside of perhaps and how you manage that, you mean to tell me that you've told me all of this in the space of 3 weeks?"
"Yes.
It only took him around a week to learn his letters."
"You taught it to read as well?"
"Yes, he's a remarkably quick learner."
"I notice you repeatedly refer to it as he."
"Yes, I do. Your point being?" Douglas spoke in an insouciant manner calculated to irk his brother. "My point being that it is senseless to ascribe a sex to an inanimate thing. It cares nothing for your choice of reference." "Well, you may disapprove of my choice of pronoun amongst other things, but you can't deny them what I managed to achieve what you were able to do. He has been churning out all sorts of wonderful and ingenious music this last week. But what you heard then was merely a prelude. There are scores of music here written in the android's own hand, and that's not all." Doug was sit down somewhere near the automaton's chair and whistled around in the dark. He retrieved a piece of paper. "What does that look like to you?" he asked as he handed it to his brother. "A child's crudely drawn ship," answered George, as he inspected the drawing. The lines were irregular, the proportions far from accurate, but the basic impression of the drawer's objective had been achieved, even if they had not mastered adequate control of their pencil. "The automaton drew it, from a picture he saw in one of the books I showed him." "Why did you make it do that? Did you mess around with its input system?
No, I didn't touch anything inside of it. I came upstairs one afternoon to find him sketchy. At the time I thought he was writing down the score, but then he got up, tapped me on the shoulder and presented me with a drawing. But how could... George frowned at the automaton. Impossible. You must have done something to it. Did you alter the parameters of its mental capacity? No, not that I'm even sure whether I could do that. Then either you're not telling the whole truth, or you're doing this yourself to try and fool me. George puts the drawing at Douglas, whose hand mechanically reached for it while his mind was elsewhere. He laid the crumpled drawing aside and stuck his folder to his pockets. He held himself uneasily, thinning his lips and looking down at his feet. At length he took a long intake of breath, and exhaled sharply from his nose as he worked himself up to speak. George, I don't think we should hand it over to the Earl. What do you mean? How could we possibly not do so? I mean that, well, I don't think you realise exactly what you've created. He's more than just a mechanical composer. I truly think this android is unlike any of the other models we've constructed in the past. I believe it actually has consciousness. Consciousness. Are you serious? Deadly. Why, just because you claim it drew a belt? No, not just because of that. It's some other things too. That it could operate beyond the parameters I determined in its design is inconceivable. Can it not learn? Not to such a great extent as that. This is all a mere fancy of yours. You are seeing what you wish to rather than what is really there. What do you not see? When you look into its eyes, do you really not see it? See what? George looked at the automaton hard in the face as Douglas continued speaking. When you look into the eyes of an automaton, even an advanced one, it does not look back at you. Even a bird doesn't look at you in the same way an intelligent creature would. But he is different. When you look into his eyes, you really feel there's something there behind them. George, it's alive. Not just alive, but a fully self-aware, sentient being.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at HereYouAreAZ.com.